We are going to continue our study that we have been doing on and off. I try to get one in about once a month or so. But we've been going through the various books of the Bible and giving a brief summary about what that book is about, so we're familiar with the contents of it and how it is organized. The book of James is where we're at, and James is probably one of those books that we probably make comparable to some of the books of wisdom, like Proverbs or Ecclesiastes. James is full of really practical information about the Christian's life. Now, one of the things that when we look at the book of James that is greatly debated is exactly who wrote it. Because one of the problems we have is James is actually a fairly common name in the times in which the Bible was written. And there have been a number of debates about exactly which James are we talking about. In fact, the word James is actually the Greek form of the Hebrew word for Jacob. And so that's what causes some of the problems. That's why it was so common. Now, we do understand, if we look at James chapter 1 and verse 1, just for a moment, it says, James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad, greetings. And as we go through the book, it doesn't take very long to say, you know, the person who's writing this book, whichever James it is, he assumes that whoever he's writing to is quite familiar of who he is. They know, we're the ones who are guessing, as far as which James we're talking about. Now, the fact that he calls himself a bondservant is something that oftentimes the apostles did. It doesn't necessarily mean it's exclusive to the apostles, but it is a type of greeting that you find like Paul and Peter referring to themselves as bondservants as well. If we also consider the book of Jude for a moment and look at Jude verse 1, we find it says, Jude, a bondservant of Jesus Christ and a brother of James. Of course, we don't know which James again, but if we're saying it's the James who wrote the book of James, that might give us an additional hint. But it could be Jude referring to a completely different James. That still causes us some difficulties. But as we look at the various possibilities, one of the possible James is James the son of Zebedee. That's John's brother, the one who wrote the book of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, as well as Revelation. He was killed in AD 44 and is mentioned in Acts chapter 12 and in verse 2, Acts 12 and verse 2, and he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. He was one of the earliest martyrs. He was the first of the apostles to die. Most people, when they look at as James, the brother of John, as being a possibility, almost always he's eliminated. But if you actually look at the reason why they eliminated, it's this belief that there's just no way James could have been written that soon after Christ was dead. Well, that's not really a good reason. You know, it's 14 years since, you know, roughly. Maybe we can maybe narrow it down at least 10 years. You know, there's at least a 10-year period. One can write quite a bit in 10 years. And so just to arbitrarily say, well, it's just too soon, doesn't seem to be a reasonable reason to eliminate James, the son of Zebedee. Usually it's argued also because they're saying, well, in Acts chapter 8 and verse 4, it mentions that there was a dispersion because of the persecution. And again, James is writing, and it looks like, to the dispersed Christians in his particular letter. So they said, well, we've got to have time for the dispersion to happen and this being spread in James' writing. Even then, we still got plenty of years. You know, we're not talking about such a long period of time that it's impossible to write a letter. So I don't think he can be completely ruled out, but he's not the one that most people want to point to. There's another James who's also one of the apostles. We don't often think about it, but in Matthew chapter 10, Matthew chapter 10 and in verse 3. In the listing out of the various apostles, it says Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collectors, James the son of Alphaeus. Okay. We also know that James had a brother named Joseph. It's in Mark chapter 15 and in verse 40. Mark 15. And in verse 40, it says there also were some women looking on from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the son of James the Less, and Joseph, and Salome. Now he's called James the Less because he's younger than the other apostle, James, that was named James. The problem is when you have two people named the same name, they didn't have last names like we do. Okay, so it's not like, you know, the problem we have sometimes where, are we talking about Andrew Hamilton or Andrew Long? Okay, we got at least the last name to separate that out. Okay, so what they did was they either said something about where the person came from, or some attribute about the person, or their father's name. Sometimes father's names were so common that that didn't distinguish. Something that would distinguish so that everybody would know which person you're talking about. Well, when he says James and he says James the Less, you're saying James the one who's younger than the other James, the younger James in the apostles. Or James the son of Alphaeus is another name for him. There are two passages that mention a Judas who's related to this same James. It's in Luke chapter 6 and in verse 16. Luke chapter 6 and verse 16 says, Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Depending on how you want to read that, either it's saying Judas's father was named James, and if you look at in most of the translation, mine has the son in italics, because it's not actually in the text. It could be Judas, the brother of James, just as easily. From the Greek text. Most people think it's the son of, but we can't rule out it can't be a brother of. And Acts 1 verse 13 also says the same thing. But again, that would be making assumptions on assumptions. We make it a little difficult. The other possibility, so we have two of the apostles, James the son of Zebedee, James the son of Alphaeus, are the two that could be possible. The third one is James, the brother of Jesus. That one is actually, if you look at most scholars, that's the one they favor the most. In Matthew 13, and in verse 55, Matthew 13, verse 55, says, is it not the carpenter's son, is not his mother called Mary, and his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas. So we do know James definitely had a brother named Judas who are related to Christ. Also, we know that James was a leader in the church in Galatians chapter 1 and in verse 19. So I did not see any other of the apostles except James, the Lord's brother. Okay. So he was considered a leader among the church. He was someone who was very strong in leading the church in Jerusalem. It is also noted in James, the way it's a lot of the pieces of James had written, the word choices and the phrasing in the Greek very closely match what is in Acts chapter 15. And assuming that James wrote the letter that's in Acts chapter 15, that starts with verse 23, I wanted to point out at least the beginning of that. It goes on beyond that. It says, the apostles and the brethren who are elders to the brethren in Antioch and Syria and Cilicia, who are from the Gentiles, greetings. Now, the reason why they point out is that that phrase that's translated as greetings, it doesn't appear very often in the New Testament. It appears here, it appears in James, and I think it appears in one other spot. But it's not a very common way of addressing somebody. And so that's one of the reasons. There are also a number of other little catchphrases that are in that letter that also happen to match James fairly well. And so people become to be suspecting that maybe that James, who argued they should send out a letter, maybe he wrote the letter, and he's using phrases that are very similar to what he says. But when you really come down to it, we have no clue. We got three good candidates. And any one of the three would be just as likely. You know, but it doesn't change anything about the content of it. Because if you look at all three of them, we got two of them being apostles. James, the Lord's brother, likely would have had inspiration of the Holy Spirit, being a leader in the church. So again, we can't rule out any one of them, nor say one is less likely than the other. The audience, though, as we look at that, again, as we look at James chapter 1 and verse 1, the audience is to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. Now, that's usually a way that we refer to Jews. And so looking at that, one of the thoughts is, well, either we're talking about Christians being the Jews in the New Testament era, being the Israelites in that sense, like Paul does in Romans chapter 2, or James is actually talking about those who are Jewish Christians who are scattered abroad. Interestingly, if we look at James chapter 2 and verse 2, and it'll depend on how your particular translation is translated, but in James chapter 2, verse 2, it says, "For if a man comes into your," my version says, "your assembly," but what's interesting is in that position is the word synagogue, "with gold ring and dress and fine clothes, and there comes in a poor man in a dirty clothes." So the word synagogue appears in that particular passage. Well, synagogue is the way the Jews refer to the place of their house of worship. Also, in James chapter 2 and down in verse 23, in making his points, he argues from Old Testament characters. So in verse 23, he says, "And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness." Again, he also refers to Rahab in verse 25. "In the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she sent the messengers out?" He's making a point. He's trying to argue it, and his final arguments are based on what happened in the Old Testament, something that would be significant to Jews, but it wouldn't be as good of a point necessarily to a Gentile. In particular, again, it depends on your translation, but in verse 21 it says, "Was not Abraham our father?" Okay, again, we could broaden and say, well, you know, Abraham's the father of faith, as Paul pointed out, and referred to all Christians. But if you're talking about Jewish Christians, then we're talking about direct descendants. So again, it kind of hints that we're talking about Jewish Christians here. Another hint is in James chapter 5, verse 4. It says, "Behold, the labor, the pay of the laborers who mow your fields, and which has been held against you, cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth." That's not Sabbath. That's Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts, or the Lord of armies. Okay, it actually has a Hebrew term here in the middle of the text. Even though it's a Greek text, it's using a Hebrew word in that point. And one other point is in verse 7 of James 5. It says, "Therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it until it gets the early and later rains." That's a reference to the climate in Israel. Israel has two rainy seasons. And so that would be something that was more unique to that particular area than the world in general. So because of all these allusions to the Hebrews and the Israelites, most people think that James was writing to Jewish Christians. And if that's true, what they usually conclude is that James is probably one of the earlier letters, because it really doesn't indicate or hint at that the Gentiles have yet become a part of the church. In other words, this would be, if we place this in time, it would probably be then placed between Acts chapter 8 and Acts chapter 15, when that letter went out saying, no, Gentiles are a part of the church. Now, in the middle of that is Acts chapter 12, which is where James, the brother of John, gets killed. But if we put it in that range, that's what most people do, because that's before the Jews really in mass, or before the Gentiles in mass, started becoming Christians. And so a letter going out with a lot of Old Testament references, Hebrew words thrown in, things like that, it wouldn't be unusual. And again, because of his Jewish character, his lack of mentioning of Gentiles, also is noted that there are a number of parallels between James and Romans, the book of Romans. And that leads some to conclude, and I've seen it written both ways. Either Paul wrote Romans and then James looked at it and said, I need to clarify some things and use similar type of subjects. Or James was there and Paul looked at it and said, because of what people are reading from James, I need to clarify some things. Because they cover similar ground. Along with that is in Galatians chapter 2. But it does cause a lot of people to conclude that Paul at least was familiar with the book of James, because there's too many parallels between them. In Galatians chapter 2 and verse 12, so for prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles, but when they came, he began to withdraw and hold himself aloft, fearing the party of the circumcision. James was really, from the hints of here, James was strongly Jewish, at least at the earlier points, before that the decision that, you know, the Gentiles were to be accepted. Some have read this particular line here in Galatians as saying that instead of saying some from James, saying that some were using James's letter as an argument point. In other words, twisting his statements out of context to make it sound more biased against the Gentiles, which is again a possibility. So when we add it all up, we look at all these pieces. What we often do is get a date that is somewhere usually between 45 to 49. Now, of course, James, the brother John, died in 44. And I'm looking at saying, I don't see why you have to rule out 44 or 43 or for that matter. There's really no reason to put it to 45 other than you just don't want James, the brother John, to be one of the to be possibly the author. It's the only reason I could figure out why somebody put that limit on it. The 49 was because basically of Acts 15. That was somewhere around 49-50 is when the group got together to talk about whether Gentiles which should be accepted as Christians or not in Jerusalem. So that's usually where most people place the letter. Now, as far as the purpose of the letter, and we're talking about all this background, the purpose of the letter develops the idea that pure religion or true faith is something that Christians are to be. They're supposed to have. It focuses on the practical, as we said, the practical aspects of Christian life. But it's talking about what is pure religion. What is true faith for a Christian? And It also gives a lot of the basic knowledge that new Christians need to live a life that's pleasing to God. Very often when we get new Christians and they say, well, what should I study first? One of the very first books I usually point them to is start with James. It's a short book. It's an easy to understand book. It doesn't have complex symbolisms or anything else very much in there. It's very straightforward and it has a lot of practical information on it. So that's what that book is intended for. That's one of its purposes. There are also very strong similarities between the themes of the Sermon on the Mount and what's presented in James. The author is very much familiar with the Sermon on the Mount. And a lot of the topics and parallels, in fact, there's allusions straight out of what Jesus said in his Sermon on the Mount. That's in the book of James. Now, one of the things that makes it a little bit interesting is if we try to outline James. Even though it's a simple book, it's easy to understand, it's straightforward, outlining it is kind of difficult. And the reason for that is James uses a Jewish style of argument, where you bring up a topic, and then you come back to it and explain it in full. And because you're talking about it, oh, that brings up another topic, you set it aside, and a little later you come back and you explain it in full. So topics are brought up and then set aside and then come back to it. And that's a very Jewish type of trait. For instance, I just want to show you. Let's go through James chapter 2 for a moment. James chapter 1. And we're going to start with verse 2 and read down to verse 11. It says, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let that endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives all to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But he must ask in faith without any doubting, for the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For that man ought not to expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. But the brother of a humble circumstances is to glory in his high position, and the rich man is to glory in his humiliation, because like flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and his flower falls off, and the beauty of his appearance is destroyed. So too the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away." Now I want you to know some topics that are being mentioned. He talks about trials. Well, starting with verse 12 and down to verse 16, he comes back to that topic of trials. Talks about it a little further. He talks about endurance. He mentions that because trials bring about endurance. Well, he comes back to that in chapter 5 and talks about the need for endurance in verses 7 through 11. He talks about faith because that's one of the results, the testing of your faith. Well, he comes back, chapter 2 is about faith. And talking, dealing with extents. He talks about praying for wisdom. Well, he comes back to talk about wisdom at the end of chapter 3, from verses 13 to 18. He talks about giving, the gifts that God gives, and he comes back to that again in chapter 1, verse 17 to 18. He talks about the poor. Well, the beginning of chapter 2 talks about the poor. He talks about the rich. Well, the beginning of chapter 5 talks about the rich. So this is just one small example. If you go through James, you'll find this all the way through the letter, where little keywords are brought up and then expanded later. Paul uses the same style in his writings, where he brings up a topic, sets it aside, comes back to it. So, there's a lot of ways. The reason why I'm saying this is if you look at anybody else's outlines, I haven't seen two outlines of James that are the same. And I'm not saying mine's the best one. Here is a way to outline James. Okay, we got the greeting in James chapter 1, verse 1. And then he starts talking about endurance. And that seems to be a theme that runs through chapter 1 all the way down to verse 18. In chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, which we just read, He talks about the joys and trials that we are to endure because that those trials strengthen us. And we should see the benefits from it. And that brings us joy. From that also, he talks about the need that we need to be confident in asking for wisdom from God. We cannot be double-minded. We cannot say, well, you know, I want wisdom, but you really don't want to give it to me. That's when we come to God and ask for something, we need to show some confidence that this is really what we want and that God will answer our prayers. And then he talks about what sometimes people find confusing in chapter 1, verses 9 through 11, is basically he's talking about this idea of glorying in proper view of your circumstances. Going back to verse 9 through 11, he says, but the brother of humble circumstances is to glory in his high position. He may be poor in this world, but he has Christ. Then turns around and says, the one who's rich should be glorying in his humiliation. You might have a high position in this world, but it's that the fact that you are just another Christian is what you should take glory in. So a proper view of your circumstances. And then also in verses 12 through 18, he talks about the blessings of enduring through temptations. Now, we all face temptations. James has probably got the best explanation of what happens as we slide into sin because of temptation. We have to endure. And when we do endure, we have the blessings from God. From that endurance, which is our faith being tested by trials, he then moves on to the fact that we got to put it into action. It's not enough just to say, I held on. Faith is shown by what we do. And so he says in James chapter 1, starting with verse 19, to verse 21, that we need to put aside the any wickedness we may have, and listen to what God actually says. It's not about us, it's listening to what God says. And from James 1, verse 22 to 25, we have to do it, not just listen. In fact, let's take a look at that passage for a moment. It says, but prove yourselves doers of the word, and not merely hearers who delude themselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror. For once he looked at himself and gone away, he has immediately forgotten what kind of person he was. But the one who looks intently at the perfect law, the law of liberty, and abides by it, not having become a forgetful hearer but an effectual doer, this man will be blessed in what he does. We have to put what we learned into action. Otherwise, we'll forget it. And otherwise, it doesn't do anybody any good, including ourselves. It's not enough just to learn. It's not enough just to hang on. He then tells us that pure religion is when you control your tongue. He comes back to this in chapter 3. In fact, this starts setting up an outline for the rest of James. Pure religion is that you control your tongue. Verse 22. I'm sorry, 26. If anyone thinks himself to be religious and yet does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. If you can't control what you say, if you can't think before you speak, your religion is worthless. He then also then says that pure religion and undefiled religion, verse 27, in the sight of our God and Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained from the world. Pure religion is helping the weak and staying unspotted. And he talks about our relationship to weaker brethren later on in the book. In fact, in James chapter 2, starting verse 1 and going down to verse 13, he talks about the fact that faith is not partial. We're talking about putting our faith into action. We cannot be biased to one person over another. You can't look down on the poor. We can't elevate the rich. And of course, what we're very familiar with in James chapter 2, verses 14 through 26, to the end of the chapter, faith is shown in our works. Faith does not exist by itself. There are a world full of people who claim to have faith. If you don't believe me, I have dozens of notes downstairs from people who talk about the fact that, well, I'm a Christian, or I was saved back then, and then they could proceed to tell you how they did not even come close to living a Christian life. Faith is shown by what you do, not by what you claim. But faith is not just shown by what you do. It's more than that, too. Faith is also shown by what you say, what comes out of your mouth. It's wisdom. In fact, he starts out with a warning in chapter 3, which sets it up, saying, "Let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, knowing that we will incur a stricter judgment." Why is that such an important thing? Well, if you're teaching somebody else, they're depending on what you say. And as he points out in the very next verse, most of us stumble in what we say. Most of us say things that we later regret. In fact, James says that we have all stumbled in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he's a perfect man, able to bridle his whole body as well. If we can control our tongue, we can control everything. That's the difficult part, though, is actually being able to control our tongue. And so from verse 2 down to verse 12 in James chapter 3 is the need to control the tongue. He points out how much damage the tongue can do and how it cannot be inconsistent in our lives. And then he puts it into application again by saying wisdom then is shown in our behavior. There we go again. It's action plus words. It's words plus action. Showing from both directions. In fact, I like the end of James chapter 3, verse 13. I got time to read it. "But who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show it by his good behavior, his deeds in gentleness and wisdom," or gentleness of wisdom. "But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, and demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambitions exist, there is disorder and every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering without hypocrisy. And the seed of whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." Wisdom causes peace to occur, which then brings James to the next point. When we talk about faith, it's also shown by your attitude. Faith is shown by your humility. He points out the problem. We said it, you know, wisdom from God creates peace. But if you look at the beginning of verse 4, he says, "What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is it not the source of your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have. You commit murder. You're envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask." People are not getting along. There's quarrels. There's arguments. Where is it all coming from? Because the wisdom from above is supposed to be producing peace. And what James points out is all the wrong motives. People are going about their religion in the wrong way because they don't have the right attitude. From verses 4 down through verse 10 of chapter 4, James talked about the fact that we need to have humility before God. If we're going to have the right attitude, the very first thing we got to do is have the correct attitude with God. You know, compared to God, each one of us is nothing. And we have way too many people in the world who think they can tell God what he ought to do. If we're going to have pure religion, we got to understand we're created by God. He tells us what we must do. And so we must have the proper attitude. From that then comes an attitude towards our brethren in verse 11 and 12. Do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you're not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. There's only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and destroy. Who are you to judge your neighbor? And again, we have so many people who think that they can stand in judgment and decide whether somebody goes to heaven or hell. Now, it's not saying that when somebody's in sin that we cannot say that's wrong. But it's not my judgment. That's God's judgment. I'm just applying what God said. But there's a lot of times when we don't know what's going on and people decide what another person's motives are. They talk as if they know what somebody else is thinking. We don't, unless they tell you, we don't have access to that. And James is warning us, we have to have humility with our brethren. And understand it's God's judgment, not ours. And then he brings that also then to our own lives. We have to have humility in our plans. We get so bold and so arrogant, I'm going to do such and such next year. Well, how do you know you're even going to be alive next year? You got to have a little bit of humility to understand that I'm not in control. I know what I would like to do next year, but that a lot depends on whether God allows me to or not. Again, it's a humble attitude. If we develop that, going back to the beginning of that chapter, the quarrels, the arguments, the conflicts would disappear. If we just had the proper attitude of humility. From that, then James talks about our suffering. Starts out with trials, he ends with sufferings. He talks about the dangers of wealth. We don't often think about wealth as a form of suffering. But wealth carries a lot of difficulties with it. And it causes a lot of hardships for brethren. And so he talks about the wealthy and their proper attitude and use of it, and not to get arrogant with it. He talks about the fact that we have to be patient in the suffering. He talks about like sicknesses, difficulties in life, and the need that we have in leading from that from verse 7 to 11, we got to be careful what we promise. Because again, we don't have full control. In fact, let's start with James 5 and look at verse 7. Therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it until it gets the early and late rains. You too, be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near. Do not complain, brethren, against one another, so that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door. As an example, brethren, of suffering and patience, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. We count those who blessed who endure. You have heard of the endurance of Job and have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings with that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful. Life is rough. Endure. We're not here in this world very long. And verse 12, he says, but above all, brethren, do not swear either by heaven or on earth or by any other oath. Let your yes be yes and your no, you know, that you may not fall under judgment. This is very similar to the Sermon on the Mount. Be honest. You don't know what the future is going to hold. Be careful about what you say. Be careful about what you promise. And we need prayers. We need prayers of our brethren. We need prayers for one another. We need to pray to God. Because that's going to be a key element of how we get through this suffering. And at the very end of James, he talks about the fact that we need to restore the lost. In verse 19, he says, my brethren, if any among you strays from the truth, and one turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save his soul from death, and will cover a multitude of sins. in this particular case, James is kind of unique. He does not end like Paul does, telling his future plans or sending greetings to other people. He ends right here. You see, what the purpose of the church is to get people to heaven. Not just ourselves, but everyone around us. The key to it, the element, the crux of it, is that we need to restore those who are lost. Because this is the life that we have, and there's no other chance. And it's a good spot to end up on. We'd like to offer an opportunity tonight. If there's anyone who is not yet a child of God, there's no better place and time than right now to be able to put on Christ. But if you're a brethren and you've sinned, there's no better time than right now also to have the prayers of your brethren on your behalf, to go to God, that you might be restored, that we might join in entering heaven together. If there's anyone here who would like to pray as their brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward too as we stand and sing Psalm Selected.